was told a lot that I wasn't athletic and I didn't give up. Maybe to a certain limit, I'm never going to be a world-class player. But at the same time, I learned that if I learned the proper technique and everything, I can pretty much try to achieve anything that I want. And so that experience to this day, I always tell myself, I say, okay, if somebody tells you no, from their perspective, they see N-O. From my side, I see O-N, meaning on. It just turns me on to try to say, how can I prove somebody wrong?
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast.
I'm Raman Sehgal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Rajiv Sethial, the funny Indian. Raman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee.
I'm so excited to be speaking today with executive coach Sophia To. Before embarking on her coaching journey, Sophia dedicated 20 years of her career to the corporate world. She held executive positions in finance, accounting, strategy, and organizational development at Procter & Gamble and Kraft Heinz. During her tenure, Sophia served as the CFO of Walker & Company, Brands Company, a P&G subsidiary, and as the CFO of a $5 billion business unit and VP of Financial Transformation at Kraft Heinz. Sophia is passionate about giving back to her community. She contributes 15 to 20% of her time volunteering in nonprofit organizations and alumni networks, mentoring and providing coaching pro bono for students and early career professionals, leveraging her expertise and experience to pay it forward and impact the world positively.
This episode is another special one, part of our P&G alumni coaching series, where we explore relevant topics with executive coaches on a deeper level. As you may already know, the P&G Alumni Women's Leadership Forum launched a coaching program for fellow P&G alums where members can give and gain from each other. Coaching is a process that helps you unlock your full potential. Just as professional athletes have a coach to help them perform at their best, coaching can help you thrive in life. Through powerful questioning, exploration, and action planning, you can achieve an elevated leadership presence and expanded career opportunities. Coaching is for anyone willing to challenge themselves to go after their professional or personal aspirations. Over time, we'll be featuring many coaches and delving into powerful coaching topics, but P&G alumni can learn more and sign up for a first free coaching consult at coaching.pgalums.com.
I hope that you enjoy our conversation with Sophia To. Sophia, thank you so much for coming on the P&G Alumni Podcast. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm doing great. How about you?
Doing really well. And look, a lot of folks are going to know your professional story, but I want to get into what folks may not know about you before you got your professional start. Could you tell us a story from your youth?
Sure. So I am an immigrant, a proud immigrant, and I moved to the US when I was 18 to attend college. So before I moved here in Malaysia, I was something that people don't know about me, looking at my size, is that I was actually a professional athlete. I played badminton competitively. And I was also, it was called long distance runner in Malaysia, but it was actually middle distance. So I ran track 800, 1500 and 3000 meters when I was in Malaysia in high school.
Wow, that's amazing. So you're an athlete, and then that had to be something. Is that something you wanted to do? Like when you thought, okay, someday I'm going to do that professionally, or did you not really think you would?
It was kind of accidental because I thought I had to pick a sport, and I was four feet 10 inches and maybe 90 pounds.
Sure.
So I was never picked on any sports team, and my mom was warning me not to engage in any contact sport. She was afraid that I was going to be beaten up, and she was right, because I joined the basketball team and I ended up becoming the assistant coach because I keep getting bumped by people.
Right.
And when you were kids, you thought that when you play basketball, you can just kind of, I don't know, hit on the little kids on the team, right? To get an advantage.
Right.
So basketball wasn't my thing. Volleyball was too hard. And so I started to play badminton with the school janitor after school. Mm. And he was really good at it. And then some of the teachers actually joined us, and I started to play with the teachers and the janitors, never with like my peers, my schoolmates. So I thought, hey, I can try out for my badminton school team. Wasn't picked for it. I had, at that time, the coach told me that I had zero chance because I was too short compared to all the kids who were trying out. A teacher took me under his wings and then actually taught me how to play badminton. So I tried out again, made it to the team, and then actually started to win games to the surprise of a lot of people.
Wow. Right.
And so it was a really very crucible experience for me to kind of overcome, I guess, my physical limitations. And my running also was a byproduct of my badminton playing, because I was running every single morning, like 5 or 6 in the morning, to try to build my stamina.
Wow.
And then when one of the school athletes had to drop out, my coach put me on the track, and I ended up winning the 3,000 meter to the surprise of everyone again.
Wow.
So I became a long distance runner.
Yes. Wow. That is amazing. What a story. That's really incredible. So if you flash forward back to today, right? How do you think you're similar to that younger version of you, and how do you think you're different?
I think I'm similar. I think I was told no a lot because of my physical size. And also I am still very nearsighted. So that was before contact lenses. I was wearing thick glasses. I did really well at school. So at that time, I was told a lot that I wasn't athletic. And I didn't give up. And I think my badminton experience really showed me that I can overcome it. Maybe to a certain limit, I'm never going to be a world-class player, but at the same time,
sure.
I learned that if I learned the proper technique and everything, I can pretty much try to achieve anything that I want. And so that experience to this day, I always tell myself, I say, okay, if somebody tells you no, from their perspective, they see N-O. From my side, I see O-N, meaning on.
Oh,
so it's a way for me to kind of hack my mind and say that when somebody tells you no, it just means on from your perspective, right? How can I prove somebody wrong? So that stays the same for me. On the other side, if I think about what was different about me, I do think that I have kind of mellow in the way that I try to achieve excellence. Like I started to interpret success criteria and excellence differently as I age. I started to say that, okay, if you are a winner, you should win in a kind of balanced way. Almost like Joe Mollers always say, top line and bottom line, balance, growth, right?
Right.
So I actually started to pay a lot more attention in different areas in my life and say, okay, think about your ikigai. Are you balanced in different areas in your life? Career, family, community, spirituality. So all of that, I started to have a different perception of what success criteria should mean.
Right. Gosh, I love that. That's so great. That's so well said in terms of the comparisons and contrasts. What is the first way you made money? Do I have this right that you started working in a restaurant?
So I opened a restaurant with my husband when I was 23 in rural Alabama. So that town has 6,500 people.
Wow.
And it was right after I graduated from college. I got an accounting degree, but I have to confess the last quarter, I think it was quarter system at that time, I kept thinking about opening a restaurant because I was working in a restaurant front of the house and my husband was the chef back of the house. I kept thinking that we have a perfect combination here that we can actually open a restaurant.
Right.
So I saw an ad in the Chinese newspaper in Atlanta, and that says that there was a restaurant for sale. And then so we just drove to Alabama to convince the person who was selling the restaurant to sell the business to us. Yeah, he owns the building, so he wants somebody like stable to run his business because he was retiring. So we have $10,000 in saving. We have a credit card that has a $10,000 limit. So we talked to the owner, Mr. Fu, mm-hmm. and say, I asked him, how about we work for you for 2 weeks for free so that you can see what kind of people we are, right? Because he needed to find somebody. somebody he can trust for 5 years, 10 years, that depending on the lease term. So he actually agreed with it. He laughed about it at first, but and then he thought it was kind of cute maybe because I was young.
Right.
I think I looked like I was 18. And then he's a very nice person from Taiwan, Mr. Fu. And then he said, yeah, why don't you work for me for free then for 2 weeks? And then after 2 weeks, he actually agreed that we can buy the restaurant from him and then we pay him by installment. So we gave him that $10,000 from our savings,
wow.
Cash, $10,000 from our credit cards, $20,000, and the remaining $70,000, the whole business he was selling to us for $90,000. The remaining $70,000, he let us pay in installment over 2 years. That was a huge breakthrough for us, a huge one, because as an immigrant at that time, I was in the United States for 4 years by that time. So it was a huge deal for us, almost like a breakthrough for us to actually put down roots in America.
Right.
And in a town that is very rural, non-diverse, no less. Yeah.
Right. Where was this specifically?
It was in Arab, Alabama. It's 30 minutes south of Huntsville.
Okay, 30 minutes south of Huntsville. Right. Okay. Yes, that is uh-huh. amazing. And one of our co-hosts, Raman Segal, is actually from Alabama, and his family also grew up, you know, as a Asian, South Asian, as opposed to East Asian, but still an Asian experience in Alabama. So he had a good one down there. He still has a map of Alabama in his room. So it couldn't have been too traumatizing. So.
No, we have great experience there, actually. And at that time, I wasn't really thinking about race or anything, even though we were the only one of the two Asian families in the whole town.
Wow.
I didn't feel anything differently, maybe because I was almost like a service provider there, right? I was,
sure.
Our restaurant was 4,500 square feet.
Right.
And so a lot of the families there actually, when they have friends in town or families in town, they took them to our restaurant. So it's almost like a place where they kind of show up to their friends and family. So it was a very good experience.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that as someone who's obviously Asian, but also born and raised in this country. So that's nice to hear. So very, very cool. So do you use your education? I mean, obviously Clayton State and then Harvard, Kennedy, which is a big deal. And then Purdue School of Business. I mean, you feel like you use it. You must have used it a lot in finance, I'm sure.
I use it a lot. So I think there was somebody, I think Sidney Harris said something that always stay with me. He said that education turns mirrors into windows.
Mm.
For me, I definitely use my education, my certification as a way for me to pivot, for me to create new path. So people laugh at me when I have all these acronyms behind my name. I told them, I love to study. I love to read. I'm very curious. And I always believe that if I study according to what the certification is testing me for, I'm getting the best of the knowledge there, right?
Absolutely.
But I definitely leverage education for me to open that window and open the door and building my network. And every place that I try to kind of venture in that is new to me, I always started to figure out, okay, what school or what training or can I get so that I can actually have a glimpse of that world, because I don't have any other way to access that world that I want to reach, right? Yeah.
Right. No, that's so well said. I was giving that advice to a younger person in my family the other day, just saying get as many credentials as you possibly can. And I know I sound like an uncle, an Asian uncle, and she's like, you so do. But I'm like, that's true though. Just getting those tangible credits and certifications are so important. So How did you discover what you're good at along the way? So maybe early part of your career or whatever else. I mean, how did you choose the path that you eventually took?
I do want to say that I'm from a working class family. So people would say, okay, you ask a kid, what do you want to do when you grow up? I was never really asked that question because my family just assumed that she would just do whatever is going to help the family, right?
Sure.
So it was actually, for me, a privilege if I can just say that I want to do anything that I want to do, which I tell my kids all the time. I was like, you are so lucky that you can actually ask that question. So for me, coming to America, that's a big breakthrough. Studying in college, getting my accounting degree, thinking that I was going to be an accountant, but later on I became a restaurant owner. That I just literally just follow my path to say, okay, what is the next, almost like the next in supply chain, we say X curve, right? Mm-hmm. That I can create. And I am a very curious person and I hate being bored. So when I feel that I'm starting to get stalled and not really growing,
sure,
I started to try to find that, I don't know, the next set of ladder to try to see what I can find out there. I do think that at the beginning, before I had anything, it was harder that way. It was scarier that way. But later on, it got easier and easier as I started to build up that safety net, not only in terms of the relationship safety net, but also the financial safety net, right? For me to be able to say, okay, I'm going to continue to invest in myself so that I can reinvent myself all the time.
I love that. And you could tell that with all the letters after your name that you have certainly followed that path, which is so cool, or multiple paths, I should say. So in terms of challenges, you know, we all have successes and failures, big and small. We all have them if we've gotten out there in the world. And as best as you can tell, what marks the difference between when you fail and when you succeed?
I think I have gotten to a point where when I fail, I know that it's just temporary. Because after I processed my failure, I started to think about what I learned from it. I do want to say that I kind of pride myself to never make the same mistake twice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I actually do every time. Yes, I fail. It's hard to take. But at the same time, I'm very good at thinking back and trying to dissect and say what I can learn from this. Sometimes it's just that, oh, this is just not for me. That's it. That's the lesson, right?
Right.
So I will try again. And sometimes it's just, okay, what ego that got into me, right? That made me kind of want to really win all the time, or what can I not say? What should I say? What should I have done to kind of prevent the mistake? But it sounds cliche, but you really do not actually fail if you actually learn from your, what you call, mistakes. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. That's a good perspective. And speaking of that, that's a good parlay into the next question, which is, what is the most common mistake that people in your field make? And I guess we could define your field in a few different ways, right? Because there's the finance piece and then there's the coaching piece. So maybe let's say coaching, because I think that is a fascinating arena for people. You know, you see a lot of people go into it who have a lot to say, and I can already tell that you've got a lot of wisdom to dispense, and you've already dispensed some here. There are a lot of people, and I've met a lot of them who, I don't know. They're just like, okay, I could have read that on Instagram. I just didn't really think that was all that inspirational, or that seemed like you just kind of Googled that. So what do you think, though, like what makes a successful piece of coaching advice, and what is not so, you know, what are the mistakes and trip ups that people make on the way there?
I think our human instinct is that when something happens, we started to try to say, okay, this is not my fault. Something happened, right? I don't have any control over, and started to try to shift blame so that it's not as uncomfortable to try to look inside yourself and say, what part did I play that is contributing to this uncomfortable situation?
Right.
And I do think that in coaching, why I love this profession so much is we create a completely safe and confidential space for somebody to kind of process that, to come down and to really think about it and process it, and so that they can move on. So if you think about, nobody wants to fail, right? It's very uncomfortable. But at the same time, this discomfort is a signal for you to say, what is it about it that is in conflict, maybe with your values, or in conflict with your passion, or in conflict with your principles. So I think all of those are signals to you that, you know, something may have to change either about you or about the situation. And another benefit of in terms of coaching is also to help you to think through what you can control and what you cannot control, right? And then what you can do about it. It's almost like separating the noise and challenging your own assumptions and your own biases.
Right.
And it's a very powerful way of thinking. And it's kind of interesting because like the different things that I'm doing, they are all kind of culminating into my coaching profession now. I took a leadership decision-making class at Harvard Kennedy School.
Mm-hmm.
We have a book club going on. We were reading the book Noise by Daniel Kahneman.
Right.
And his other co-author. And they were talking about decision-making on how we really need to differentiate between what is noise and what is your own biases. And it was such a great tool now that even every time for myself, when I'm trying to make decision or with my clients, for them to think things through, we started to go down the path of what is noise, which is the information that is not relevant to your decision making. And what are your biases or your assumptions?
Right.
Or assumptions that you have always hold true to, are they worth validating? So I do think that it's a great way for my clients to actually think things through when they started to say, okay, systematically, first process the feelings, identify the feelings after you process it, creating that space to actually think about how you can move forward in a better way.
I love that. I mean, how do you differentiate, and especially now, it seems like things are so integrated where there's, you know, people say work-life balance and personal versus professional. Do you find that it gets into therapy sessions and things like that? How do you draw those boundaries when somebody's coaching and you're like, wow, this seems like a bigger issue. Maybe you need a therapist. Like, where does that line end for a life coach or a coach, an executive coach like yourself, and where a therapist begins?
Yeah. So actually in my onboarding session with my client or any discovery call, I always start out by saying, number one, have you experienced executive coaching before? And then the follow-up question is telling them about the differences between therapy, coaching, and mentoring.
Mm.
So therapy basically is looking back to try to heal from the past to help you mentally. And coaching definitely in a way differentiating from therapy is looking forward. Okay. So what is getting you stuck? What did you learn about it? What is your learning about yourself? What are the action plans that you can take? And then there's also this component of accountability and thought partnership. They kind of co-create these solutions together so that the clients can move forward. So definitely forward looking for coaching. And then mentoring is more one way in terms of somebody who has experience and expertise kind of giving this advice to someone, which is not really a partnership per se, but it's just giving this one way advice to someone who is maybe younger or younger tenure in an organization.
And now a word from our sponsor. Today, we're talking to Bernice Ang, a board member of the P&G Alumni Women's Leadership Forum, a community of high-impact P&G alumni women with the drive, resources, and experience to make a positive and meaningful difference. So, Bernice, I understand the Women's Leadership Forum is launching a coaching program, especially for our P&G alumni. Can you tell me why you guys are doing this?
Hi, Raman. Yes, you know, our mission is to be a force for growth that empowers women to reach their full potential. So we create platforms like this coaching program where our members can bond and sisterhood to both give and gain from each other.
That's so great. I mean, I feel like we're hearing a lot more about coaching these days. Who would you say that things like coaching is best for?
Coaching is a process that helps you unlock your full potential through three things. One is powerful questioning, where we gain clarity on the goals or issue. Two, exploration, where we delve deep and reflect on the forces at play. And three, action planning, where we focus on behavior changes that lead to powerful results. So just as professional athletes have coaches to help them perform at their best, coaching can help professionals like you and me thrive in work and in life. And so it's for high-performing people who are willing to challenge themselves and go after their dreams, whether it's about their careers or personal aspirations, so that each day they can become better than they were the day before.
So how exactly does this form of professional coaching that you guys are going to be offering, how does it work?
We typically start by understanding what the person wants to accomplish and why it's important to them. Then we paint a crystal clear picture of their desired outcomes, where we uncover roadblocks as we go, like if they have a fear or lack certain skills, then we support them to take consistent actions to attain those outcomes. And in the course of 3 to 6 months, the client actually generates very real, tangible results for themselves, session after session.
That makes a lot of sense. So who exactly are these P&G alumni coaches, and what are their types of credentials?
We're a small, diverse team of P&G alumni women who are trained professional and certified coaches. We've been practicing for a number of years, and we each have at least 15 years of senior leadership experience in Fortune 500 companies. So we've led multi-billion dollar businesses and developed many, many high-performing leaders. And at this point in our lives, we want to be a resource for our younger alumni to help guide them through their journey.
It sounds like really powerful and important work. So how can folks find out more to take advantage of such a great service?
Just go to coaching.pgalums.com to learn more. And we're actually offering a limited number of free coaching engagements for the next 6 months so that our alumni can personally experience the power of professional coaching. And I invite anyone listening to take advantage of this great offer by registering at coaching.pgalums.com.
Well, thank you so much, Bernice. Best of luck with this program. Can't wait to hear more.
Thanks, Ramon.
And now, back to our show.
That is such a great dichotomy between the past and the future, because that is something I've wondered about for a long time. So thanks for spelling it out so clearly. That is a very clear dividing line and super helpful to think about. Look, we all face forks in the road, inflection points where decisions set us on a path and we may go one way or another. What was one of those first ones for you where you feel like this is a fork in the road?
The first one? Okay. The first one definitely is when I decided I'm not even going to interview for my accounting jobs and opening a restaurant, right? So because like people are like, after 4 years of schooling, getting a bachelor's degree in accounting, and you decide to open the Chinese restaurant.
Right.
So that was one of the first one. But I just thought that at that time, it was such an ideal combination between me and my husband, where he was a really good cook. And then I was really good front of the house because I was helping a big restaurants with several chain restaurants to open up their new restaurant. I was like, okay, we can do this ourselves.
Yes, you really leveraged your strengths of you and your partner. And I guess it wasn't a fork in the road. It was a chopstick in the road. Can I make that joke?
Okay, let me see how does it work here. Yes.
Okay.
Parallel. You land them up parallel in a parallel way, right? Like a parallel universe.
I like that. Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, they're side by side. Exactly. Oh, that's perfect. I love the analogy. So that's great. I love the contrast between those two, where you could have interviewed for these accounting jobs and instead you went on this different path. So when did you become you? And what I mean by that is like when you look back at the younger version of you, and we already talked about some of the similarities and differences, but where do you feel like, I'm fully formed now. And maybe this was the assignment that did it. Maybe it was at P&G. Maybe it was at Heinz. Where do you think that happened?
So are we ever fully formed? I think that is the big question there.
Right. Fair.
Well, I do want to say, I actually have been thinking about that a lot because I wasn't a typical finance person per se. Well, at least from my perspective, that I almost like laugh too much, smile too much, you know, too optimistic probably. Mm-hmm. So I think for early on in my career, I kept kind of beating myself up for being like too optimistic, keep thinking about all the different solutions. But later on, I actually quite embrace my positivity trait because for me, it now means resilience. It now means possibilities.
Right.
It also means why I kept seeing potentials in everyone.
Right.
So I actually do really embrace that trait of mine where I see a lot of opportunities every time when we get into like a crisis situation. I keep thinking about, okay, what can we learn from this that is going to give us a breakthrough idea And so I very much embrace that part of me now. But early on in my career, you know, finance people, right? We have all these risks that we need to call out. And I was in big project where I forced myself to identify what could go wrong. And I remember in a project, I identified like 35 risks, things that can go wrong. completely catastrophized my project. But looking back, I actually quite embraced myself that the moment that I own that I am a positive person, I am a person who sees possibilities, I think that's when I gain my confidence. That's when I really own myself, own my leadership in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. So sort of pivoting here to mentors and leaders that we admire. I mean, who have been some of your mentors and leaders that you have admired along the way?
Oh, so many. There are so many. So I have four mentors.
Wow.
I mean, Laura Becker, who is the president of our Global Business Services right now. She is like a guiding light for me throughout my career. I mean, I looked up to her. She's a role model. And we got paired up as mentor and mentees. The first 3 months when I was starting with P&G in 2005, just because I feel in the form that, you know, I want a woman mentor. I want a woman mentor with kids and a woman mentor whose husband stays at home. And we got paired up. And so she has always been one of my role model and my guiding star. Dwight Smith, who I think he has retired.
Okay.
He was the VP of finance. I learned so much from him. He was so objective and he kept pushing me to just be very good at everything that you do, like mastery and be objective. So he really pushes me to think things through and not taking things the easy way and always do the right thing. And then I have Saurabh Sasetna, who was my mentor in the FAN network, which is Finance and Accounting Asia Network.
Okay.
Yeah, I learned a lot from him too. And then Mike Hoffman. I can name you a lot of names, but I really want to say that I really felt that, yeah, we don't want to like kind of attribute everything to luck, but I do think that this is one of my lucky breaks to be able to work at P&G where we emphasize so much growing our people and developing our people.
Right. I would agree wholeheartedly with that. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at diversity and adversity, many in our audience are from increasingly diverse backgrounds. And not to say that I'm diverse and you're diverse, but when people think of diversity, they tend to think of, you know, South and East Asians and including several others in that mix. Women, minority professionals. Can you share a moment where you experienced or observed professional adversity being treated differently because of your background?
I wasn't really paying attention to it until maybe a few years ago when there were all this discussion about diversity. Maybe all the rhetoric out there just got a little bit hostile, right? To people who are not from here, people of color.
Right.
So my kids say, okay, you have turned woke now. I was like, no, not really. I was just kind of maybe napping in a way. Maybe, yes. But I always attribute the people's behavior to like, oh, they're just like a rude person or they're just unhappy people. So I never really tried to say, okay, this is racism or anything.
Sure.
But thinking back, I now actually do realize that there may be some subconscious or unconscious thing they are going on to, which is a normal human behavior because everyone has biases. We just need to learn how to identify them. You have biases, I have biases, but we just need to catch ourselves and identify it. So looking back, I do think that, yeah. So some of the experiences that I have when people just, without knowing me and my capabilities, just say that, oh, I don't see her as somebody who can lead or just kind of looking at my label and then judge me that way. I definitely do think that I probably have got disadvantage because of that. Just the perception of when people look at how I look, how I talk.
Uh-huh.
But I now actually, I am okay with it because I actually, now that I am a coach, I am I'm good at framing, right? So now I look back at the, okay, my intersectionality.
Right.
Which means my multiple identity, right? My intersectionality actually is helping me, not hurting me. When I first learned about this word intersectionality, meaning that your different identities, your social identities, your political identities, all combined together are giving you different privileges or disadvantage in the society, I initially thought of it as something like a totem pole. It helps you to get higher or higher or lower or lower.
Sure.
And then, so I used to think that, okay, oh gosh, I'm a woman. Okay. I am Asian. I am an immigrant. I have an accent. So I started to put myself lower and lower in the totem pole.
Sure.
But now when I think about it, I thought it actually became my advantage because my intersectionality, I'm from Malaysia. I'm Chinese Malaysian. I'm Chinese Malaysian American who has lived in America for 34 years.
Wow.
It actually became my advantage because I felt that I can connect with people so much quicker than everybody else.
Hmm.
Because it means that I can connect to my team. I can empathize with my team.
Right.
I can understand what people are going through so much quicker. And then the relationships that I built with all these identity groups are so strong that people always say, oh, how can we know everyone? Well, it's because I am Chinese, I'm Malaysian, I am American, I am...
Right.
So I do think that it became my almost like my safety net. And then coming out as a coach, as an entrepreneur, as a coach, my multiple networks definitely show up and almost making it a trampoline for me. And not only serving as my safety net, but also becoming a trampoline because I have so many people like showing up, trying to help me to establish my business. Yeah.
That's really helpful to think about because with me, with diversity and inclusion, I really feel, and I know how you talked about past and future, you know, where therapy is about the past and coaching is about the future. I think that's the big shift that happened in this country of the United States when diversity really went from future thinking to past thinking. In other words, we're all the same and let's move forward together. And then it became this, let's look back and look at all the ways that we, you know, it becomes this sort of repression Olympics where it's like, let's look at all the ways that we're disadvantaged. And I thought, well, this is a country that's supposed to be empowered and you come here and it's the strength of the individual and, you know, be all you can be. And then suddenly everybody became a victim. And it sort of was like, wow, if you're a white man, you're a victim. If you're a black woman, you're a victim. It's like everyone gets to be a victim now. And you go, well, which one is it, guys? Is it that we're all different or we're all the same? And I think it's really, really hard to relate to that sometimes where you're going, it's good to embrace our heritage. Of course, I'm a very, very proud Indian, very proud Hindu, very proud South Asian. But at the same time, you know, it's good to remember what makes you, but we are still human and we're losing that human connection, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's fear, right? It's fear of change. Change is inevitable, but the resistance to change is the one that is creating that discomfort, creating that fear.
Right.
Because I always think back to my experience at that small town in Arable, Alabama.
Right.
Where people actually went out of their way to welcome me. I had people stopping by saying that, are you being treated well? Like, are people here? And then never realizing that the town actually has a history as a sundown town.
Oh.
But I never experienced anything differently. And then I made some best friends that to this day I am still keeping in touch with my customers.
That's great.
I'm still friends with some of my customers from 30 years ago. That's crazy, huh?
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, are these white folks?
Yes.
Are they Asian?
Yes.
Or are they both?
They're traditional white folks who have that really like almost like traditional American spirit, right? Kindness and all that stuff. So which leads me to believe that when we're scared, we do things that they're probably not our best selves.
Right.
Right. That I really do think that it's the fear that is getting into play here. Where everyone is trying to say, okay, how can I protect myself? How can I protect my families? and don't know what to say, don't know how to have difficult conversations.
Yeah.
When in reality, we are different, but we are also the same. And there is a belief that race is a social construct, right? Because
yeah.
I think there are all these studies that shows that if you look at our DNA, come on, we are all kind of all together in the same pool here.
Totally.
In the same species, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I know when people always say that everybody's different, I'm like, I don't know. I think everybody's the same. I think we want the same things. I mean, whether you're wherever you are on the gender spectrum or the racial area or wherever it's, you know, we want our lives to mean something. We want companionship. We want to make a difference. You know, we want to feel good. We want to have fun. We want to share things with people. I mean, yeah, that's how most people are. I mean, that manifests in different ways. But my gosh, those are universal truths. That's why whenever you hear a song about that or see a movie about that in any language, it resonates.
Yeah, like even in internet generationally, right? We kept like the generation are keeping pointing fingers to each other, but at the same time, we all want the same thing. Maybe the younger generations are more empowered and to actually demand and ask for what they want, but this is not to say that the boomers are not wanting the same thing too, but except that maybe they are being conditioned, right? Not to ask for it.
Right. Correct. No, I could not agree more. Look, I mean, we think about the future, now in the future, we've been living through some particularly crazy and challenging times. And maybe some of the things that you mentioned where, I don't know if it changed in this country or whatever else, but as a purpose-driven leader, and you've led large organizations, you've been part of large organizations, you've started your own. What advice would you give to our leaders?
So Viktor Frankl said something that is really meaningful to, well, he wrote a fantastic book, right? Man's Search for Meaning. But he said something about between our reaction to something, right? When something happens to us and then we react to it, there's a space. And then leaders plays in that space.
Mm.
So as leaders, I know our stereotypical perception of a boss or a leader is somebody who just are very reactive, right?
Uh-huh.
Who just command and control or anything. But he actually said that leaders place in that space between reacting and when things happen. Because if a leader creates space and be very intentional when dealing with their people, especially bad things happen, that shows up as a leader. Because we at P&G, we talk about moment of truth all the time, right? And I do think that there's that important employee moment of truth that really shows up only when bad things happen, only when you have a crisis. And that's how you show your true color to your people, whether you really care for them, whether you really want to help them to drive that clarity or not. So I do think that leaders need to remember that if you are leaders, it's a privilege that you need to earn to keep, because your people are watching you on how you behave. Yeah.
You have three children?
Two
children. Okay. So you have two children. What would your children say that they've learned from you?
What have they not learned from me?
Right. Because, exactly right. Because, yeah, they owe you everything.
No. So I remember one Christmas I was driving a car with my nieces, nephews, and then my kids. So it's like more than my two children.
Right.
They said, how come you keep asking them, what did you learn from this? We will be experiencing something. I'll be asking them, what did we learn from this experience? And they were so annoyed that I always asked them, what did we learn from this experience?
Yeah.
But I did learn so much from my two young adults. My daughter is 22. My son is 18.
Mm.
Because they really pushed me to think. They would challenge me. My daughter, she's probably more liberal on the liberal side. And my son, he's more on the conservative side. And every time when I see them having a healthy debate, and I say healthy, I was so proud to see that they can actually have a disagreement on a topic and they were really trying to give each other's respects when they're trying to talk out the issue.
Right.
So I learned so much from my kids in the sense that they are really thoughtful about the future. And I mean, our world is not doing any better, right? Global warming and everything. And I do think that
right.
we are not painting a bright picture for our younger generation. So I learned so much in a sense from them about inclusion, how to listen to each other. And they are really pushing for what work means for them.
Right.
And they are a lot more resourceful. They have like multiple gigs going on. So I do think that, yes, we can say that the Gen Z right now, you know, what's going on there, but try to talk to them like you're a student and you will really enjoy the insights that these kids have. It's not just my kids. Like when I talk to college students, I talk to my nieces, nephews, I am so inspired by them. I just don't want to be the ones who are getting in the way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. You're right. There are times where the young should learn from the old, and there are other times where the old should learn from the young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's wrap this up with some rapid fire questions. You know, there are no right or wrong answers, but we'll keep the answers relatively short. And I always struggle with this myself because I tend to talk in paragraphs, not sentences. And you and I are kindred spirits in that regard, although you're better at it than I am. Which fact about you surprises people? When they come to know it, it surprises. Would it be the professional athlete thing or maybe something else?
Probably the professional athletes thing. Probably the professional athletes one. It surprises people because you can't tell from my size that I can beat you in badminton. Yeah.
Right. Yes. And as a fellow short person, fellow short Asian, I really respect that. So glad to hear it. What is your go-to media escape? Is it movies or books or TV?
Definitely books. So I love that I now read books as part of my profession. I'm trying to better myself for my clients. So I'm like reading. But I've been reading since I was, I don't know, 5 or 6 every single day. I read maybe 2 hours a day. I'm running 2 books.
That's great.
2 book clubs. I love to read, and reading also helped me to recharge too. So every time I attend like a big event or a big conference, I will hold up in my reading room and just read so that I can get that recharge. Yeah.
Do you read fiction or nonfiction or both?
I read a lot more nonfiction now just because it's helping me with my work too, right? Because I coach executives from corporate, nonprofit, and the public sector. A lot more business books and self-help. But when I'm on vacation, I read fiction. Because when I fly, I read fiction. Because I like to read my fiction in one go. I don't like to set it down because I'm constantly working on multiple books. I think I'm reading like 4 books right now at the same time. So
that's great.
So it's hard to kind of patch the story back together if I read fiction that I kind of change and read another book. Yeah.
What is your favorite time of day and what are you usually doing then?
5:30 in the morning. 5:30 in the morning. I am an early bird. Yes. Watching the sunrise from my window.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. If you did not do your current job, which profession would you like to attempt? I mean, I guess you already did finance and some other things, but what's something you have not tried that you're like, you know what? I would have liked to try that.
I think I probably would be a pretty good event planner. I am an arranger. Mm. So I actually love things that are unexpected and see what I can pull out of my head. Yeah.
And no disrespect to the people who do this for a living, but what is a profession you would not like to attempt? Do you think would not be a good fit for you?
I don't know. This is a rapid fire, right? Real estate agent, because I get lost all the time and I really do not want to leave my clients getting lost trying to look for their new house. Yeah.
That's so great. Is there someone out there with whom you still want to get coffee, grab a cup of coffee or black tea or green tea?
You mean living or?
Let's say dead and living.
My grandmother.
Okay.
Yes, my grandmother. Mm. Yeah, she passed, but I really love for her to be able to have a conversation with her and see how, so that she can see how I turn out and see I have lived up to her standard.
Oh, I love that. I love that. That's so great. And then finally, what is one piece of advice or challenge that you would give to the next generation?
One piece of advice that I'll give to the next, there are so many advice. So that's what I'm like thinking right now. Don't sweat the small stuff. I tell my kids all the time. There are big stuff and there are small stuff and we can get angry or sad or mad at so many things, but focus on the big ones. Yeah.
I love that. Sophia, this has been super great. Anything you want to add? Otherwise, I think we've gone through my side of it and I've been super charmed by your answers. Anything you want to add?
No, I think I've said everything that I want to say, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast or email pgalumpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Rajiv Sathyal.
And I'm still Raman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.